From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the renowned historian David Blight is with us to talk about his sweeping biography of Frederick Douglass. Douglass was 20 years a slave. He was a fiery abolitionist and a brilliant orator, maybe one of the best ever in history. And Blight's book isn't just about his complex and epic life, but how he used language and words to fight slavery. Join us after this.
KUER is growing, with new reporters set to join our newsroom this year. We want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? How can we better represent your community? What stories need to be told? Help us improve our service around Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. Frederick Douglass lived 20 years as a slave, nearly nine as a fugitive after he escaped. And he managed to educate himself. He was an abolitionist, an editor, a diplomat, and the Yale historian David Blight says an orator of almost unparalleled stature. Blight has written a new and sweeping biography of Douglass, and he says, in his life, he was many things, a radical thinker, a political liberal, but also a man who became a bureaucrat and a diplomat. He was a man who hated and loved his country. Blight says few Americans have ever analyzed race with more poignancy and nuance than Douglass. Today in the program, David Blight is joining us to talk about his book, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Blight teaches American history at Yale University, and he joined us from the studios of the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut. I wanted to start with a moment, a speech that Frederick Douglass gave in April of 1876. Blight says a huge crowd had gathered in Washington, D.C. for the unveiling of a monument to Abraham Lincoln, who had been killed 11 years earlier. Blight writes about the speech in his book, and he says it was extraordinary for its remarkable honesty and for this fact that no African-American speaker had ever faced this kind of captive audience in one place before.
It's April of 1876. It's an election year. It's the big election year. It's the U.S. bicentennial, but it's also the anniversary of the Lincoln assassination. But they're unveiling this extraordinary monument of Lincoln standing with a kneeling slave with the chains being broken. A very controversial statue, but a statue that was paid for almost entirely by African Americans who had raised the money. And before the unveiling, there was a huge parade throughout the city, and it was a black parade, I mean, organized by African Americans. Frederick Douglass rode in a carriage at the end of it. But the audience was remarkable as well. The President of the United States, Grant, was there. He pulled the cord to unveil the statue. Members of his cabinet, members of Congress, members of the Supreme Court, the entire government was there. And it was declared a government holiday in the district. And the speech, I mean, Douglass could have delivered simply, a ceremonial speech and made nice on all things. But he didn't. Yeah. He gave an extraordinarily poignant, honest, direct speech in really two parts. The first part is where he famously says Abraham Lincoln was the white man's president, not our president. He goes on to say in that unforgettable metaphor, my white fellow Americans, you are Abraham Lincoln's children. I and my people are only his stepchildren, which he repeats. But then he pivots, and the second half of the speech becomes not only a warming up to Lincoln, but it becomes a very forthright statement about how Lincoln's caution and his pragmatism was in the end absolutely necessary for emancipation and winning the war. And then Douglass uses a refrain three times, under his rule and in due time, under his rule and in due time, which was in part, I think, not only Douglass's recognition of Lincoln's necessary pragmatism and sometimes caution, but also it was Douglass's way of declaring that the country freed the slaves. The United States has done this. The United States is responsible for black freedom and its aftermath. And the reason he does that, and the great subtext of that speech, of course, is that Reconstruction is at that moment falling apart.
Right.
It's Douglass's warning to this the government sitting right in front of him, beware, you are losing hold of Reconstruction. It is your responsibility, our responsibility. He converts that unveiling of that Lincoln statue into a very direct appeal to save Reconstruction at a time when he pretty much knows that may not even be possible. It's I always call it Douglass's second greatest speech,
yeah.
The first still being the famous 4th of July speech.
One of the things you talk about is how rare it is for a truly radical reformer to actually live to see the overthrow of the system they're fighting against. And here it is. Frederick Douglass is one of them. And he really perceives this Reconstruction, as you mentioned, falling apart, the sorrowful state of American democracy,
yes.
As he's saying. And this is an important theme in the book, it seems.
It is a big theme. It's one of my several big themes I try to weave throughout the book. And this is how the radical outsider, the old abolitionist, always on the outside knocking on the doors, challenging the hypocrisy of his country, nevertheless, in the middle of his life, in his 40s, experiences a victory. Mm. I mean, his cause wins.
Yeah.
And then he lives he lives 30 more years. He lives long enough to become the political insider.
Right.
So it's the radical outsider who becomes a political insider. He becomes a kind of an inside functionary of the Republican Party. He moves to Washington in 1872 and he becomes, in effect, a government bureaucrat. He attains three federal appointments, Marshal of the District of Columbia, Recorder of Deeds of the District, and eventually even U.S. Minister to Haiti, where he has to represent the foreign policy of the United States. So and so I try to weave into this story what happens to that old radical when he does achieve an insider political status. What compromises are made? What deals are made? Mm-hmm. What kinds of criticisms does he now undergo as that political insider as he ages, into the latter part of his life? It's a fascinating story, and it makes him kind of a prototype for so many more people to follow if we think of a Nelson Mandela.
Mm.
Or many of the great leaders of our civil rights movement who then became politicians. They became mayors and governors and congressmen and even senators. And then there's even Barack Obama who was not a leader in the civil rights movement. He was too young. But good Lord, he became an organizer, a community organizer, who then became president of the United States. So that path from the outsider to the insider is—he's a prototypical story for that.
Well, I thought about Barack Obama because he was also criticized for compromising too much.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, right up front, you mentioned a speech by the president where he talks about that gaze of Frederick Douglass, how that informs, as you put it, how we use our past to determine who we are. That was another
thing. I was so struck by that speech. It's the speech Obama gives dedicating the new National African American History Museum in Washington, September of 2016. And right in the beginning of the speech, he could have invoked any number of people, from Martin Luther King to Rosa Parks to Harriet Tubman to, many others. But he invoked Douglass. And he talks about seeing our history through the leonine gaze of Frederick Douglass, which is a very poignant kind of metaphor. And it is presidential rhetoric, but it was Obama and his speechwriters trying to carefully say where African American history fits in American history, which is right at the center of it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, what reading Frederick Douglass's three autobiographies actually tell you about his life, because you say he was often in the way, that he left a great deal unsaid. In fact, you put it this way. You said it's as if he slips out of the room right when you wish to know more.
Right. Well, Douglas scholars, I think, all have a fantasy of getting Douglas into a room where we could lock the doors and pin him down for like a 3 or 4 hour seminar and ask him about all those elements of his life that he did not tell us about in the three great autobiographies. But, of course, he doesn't stay in that room very long for us. He wrote 1,200 pages of memoir, the first in 1845, the second in 1855, which is his long-form masterpiece, My Bondage and My Freedom. And then he writes the third autobiography in 1881, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, when he's now becoming the old man, summing up his life and telling about all the great experiences. And then he revises it yet again 11 years later in 1892. So what you as a biographer, the first problem you face with Douglass is those autobiographies are always kind of in your way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they, of course, are a tremendous source, tremendous and at times revealing source. But he does not tell us much of anything in the memoirs about his personal or private life or his deeper inner standing. He does tell us a lot about his slave youth.
Yeah.
In a quite psychological way. In fact, one way of reading his early autobiographies is as a kind of a study of child psychology under tremendous pressure and trauma. And I try to show that in the book.
It seemed to torment Frederick Douglass not knowing his exact birth date. It was one of the projects that he always thought that, and trying to find out who his actual birth father was. He didn't.
Right.
He didn't exactly know the birth date, and that was important to him. But we know it was generally 1818, February, I guess, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah. His birth date has been determined as February. The exact date we don't know, but he was born – it's recorded February 1818. But he never knew.
Right.
He thought he was born in 1817,
but
he never knew his birth date. He never knew his father, who his father was. He knew his mother, but only vaguely. He last saw her when he was 6 years old, and he had to pretty much invent images of her. And that's one of the first facts one should know about Douglass. He was, in a thorough sense, an orphan.
Yeah.
And always looking for the question of who am I, where am I from, who am I related to, where did I come from? And that has a... That's a principal reason why throughout his life he kept hearkening back to the eastern shore of Maryland where he was born, hearkening back to that youth, hearkening back to all these potential relationships and even kinfolk, black and white, because he knew that his father was probably one of his owners or masters, but he never really knew which one. But Douglass is always so acutely aware of where he's from.
Yeah.
And in his consciousness, and even in reality, he returns many times. After the Civil War, he returned to the Eastern Shore 3-4 times very publicly to seek out his roots, even to try to figure out his paternity and try to figure out just exactly who he was blood relatives with, if he could ever figure it out.
And always, you say, trying to find these opportunities to convert his story, as you put it, into ways of defining slavery itself to others. His analysis of that seemed like, in some ways, part of his genius, the way he converted his own story into a deeper analysis of slavery and the way he explained it to everyone else.
He said at one point in the first narrative, I had decided to make slavery my study.
Yeah.
But by telling his own story, he was trying to represent the experience of slavery, represent the deep psychic phenomenon of what slavery can do to you. In fact, one of the greatest things one can get from reading Douglass's autobiographies, and it's why it's so widely taught now, but it is a coming-of-age story, and it is a real meditation on how enslavement had not only physical meaning, you know, treatment, physical scarring, if you like, but it had a deep psychological scarring, or it could have. He said many times that he feared for his body, but he feared more for his mind.
Right.
That it was his mind that was at stake primarily, the humiliations that slavery can bring. And he describes so many of – he describes lots of physical beatings. He observed, you know, a terrible degree of whippings and beatings of other people, and it's all over the memoirs. But he also describes the problem many times over of the humiliations of slavery, mm-hmm. watching an adult man or woman whipped – and realizing their irretrievable humiliation. He felt, I think, and he believed, that that was the deepest kind of trauma or scarring that slavery could leave on people, what it did to their inner sense of self, what it did to their psyche.
You mentioned, so he's desperately trying to, as you put it, preserve and protect his mind as well as his body. And you say that those experiences shaped this set of habits of mind.
Yes. Yes.
Explain that.
Well, habits of mind in the sense that he came out of slavery with a great deal of anger,
yeah,
a good deal of rage, but also passion, commitment to live, desire to use the one principal weapon he had developed, the one little kind of power that he had developed even while he was a slave, and especially while he was a slave, and that was language and words.
Yeah.
But habits of mind, too. I meant by that Douglas found it difficult to trust people,
mm-hmm.
not entirely through his life, and he certainly made close friendships. But he did not find it easy to trust. He made friends easier with women than he did with men. I'm pretty convinced of that. He also had a hypersensitivity. Now, a lot of people do, and a lot of us do, for lots of reasons that are there in our background somewhere. But he was hypersensitive to racial slights. He was also hypersensitive to slights about his lack of any education or training, any formal education. Never set foot a day in his life in a school,
yeah.
and yet he becomes this world-class writer and intellectual and leader who always was looking over his shoulder at those younger – particularly younger black leaders, who the next generation, who were usually college educated, free-born and not slave-born, and like all generations, eager to knock him off because he was the big man up on the pedestal. So there are habits of mind that he brought out of slavery that really did shape him as an adult. And another one of those habits, like it or not, was his fierce belief in what the 19th century, and we still call it, self-reliance.
Yeah.
He preached this to his kids. He preached it to black audiences. Make your own way. Build yourself up. Lift yourself up. And part of that was because he believed he had done that for himself, although he had a lot of help along the way.
Yeah.
But that kind of fierce individualism that he exhibits at times, that comes from that experience too, somehow willing your own freedom, escaping from slavery when you're only 20 years old, and then somehow making it in the world largely by your own wits. That leaves a person who is going to be deeply proud of their experience, their self-reliant, you know, creation. And that's what these autobiographies are about. He's constantly writing himself into history. He's constantly creating that self, that story of himself, because it's as though he didn't believe he possessed anything else. What else did he have but his story, you know? He has no inheritance. He certainly had a family, and we wish he'd written more about that family. We have to get at the family by other means, by letters, and other kinds of sources, which we can do. But, you know, if we had him in a room today, oh, man, Douglas scholars would have 100 questions about his children and his two wives and all those domestic elements of a very conflicted extended family that he just does not write about.
That's the historian David Blight. His book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the renowned historian David Blight is with us to talk about his sweeping biography of Frederick Douglass. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom.
I want to work through one of the themes you identify in Douglass's life, and it's words and language. In fact, you say the book is a biography of a voice in a lot of ways. For example, 1826, he's 9 years old, and he gets this incredible break. He is sent to Baltimore, and it's here that he learns. I'm just thinking about the melange of language that he's hearing on the streets. I'm thinking about what he learns from Sophia Auld, the wife of basically the person who owned him, truly kind to him, gives him this gift of literacy, reads to him from the Bible. So I'm thinking of all this mixture of language and words that are coming to him when he's only 9 years old and what he's taking in.
Yeah. Now, he comes by language young, very young, but he takes to words and language, partly because he got it through a kind of loving relationship for more than a year from this Sophia Auld, who taught him. Yeah. And pretty soon he's reading out loud. But then he also gets it from the streets, as you say. He has kind of playmates, these white playmates, these immigrant boys who are German and Irish. They're 9, 10 years old, and they're beating about the streets of Baltimore. And, you know, they haven't grown old enough to learn racism yet to much extent. And they found this little black kid who was bright and interesting and tough like them. They loved him, or at least liked him. And they had a school book with him called The Columbian Orator. And Douglass wanted a copy of that. He wondered how he could get one. He actually tells us he traded Sophia Auld's warm bread for spelling lessons. Now, you know, there's a tale for you.
Right.
But he eventually there, when he's 11 or 12, manages to buy his own copy of that magical book, The Columbian Orator, which was a school reader. It was taught as a reader in school, just like the McGuffey reader. In fact, it was the second best-selling such book in the country. But he managed to get his own copy at a bookstore for very little money that he had managed to save up. And that book became magic for him because it was not only this large collection of speeches and commentaries from both the classical era and the Enlightenment era, but it was also a manual of oratory. The first 15, 20 pages provided a kind of how-to explanation of oratory, how to modulate your voice, how to build it to cacophony, how to use your hands and your shoulders and so forth, the physicality of oratory. And it has all these lessons in it about how the great orator also must reach a certain moral message, a certain morality in their audience, how you reach and engage an audience. And the early teenage Douglass just fell in love with this book, and he writes about it in the autobiographies. And even then, when he's thrown back to the Eastern Shore for a period of time, and he's a field hand, nevertheless, he gathers what he calls a band of brothers, a bunch of guys, most of them slightly older than him. They're all teenagers or, you know, late teenagers. And they go out under the trees in a brush arbor on Sundays, and he runs what he called a Sabbath school with them, where they would practice out of that Columbian Orator. He would teach them oratory, but he would also do readings, aloud from the Bible. So the important thing to know about how this man came by language is he came by it through an oratorical sensibility, but then he also came by it through the King James Version of the Bible, by just reading it and reading and reading. Now, did he always understand all those Old Testament stories? Well, no. You know, and who does when they first encounter them?
Right.
I mean, it's all metaphor and story. But that was his source of story. And eventually what Douglass, the adult Douglass that comes out of slavery and actually becomes a preacher in New Bedford for a couple of years, and he's only in his early 20s, and then gets discovered and drawn out onto the abolitionist circuit by William Lloyd Garrison and the Massachusetts abolitionists, he's out there now. He's only 24, 25, but he's out there having already practiced a great deal of preaching to a biblical text, from a biblical text, and he's for years already been reading, often aloud, a biblical story, yeah, such that Douglass found ways to place his own story, the story of his people, meaning African Americans, and the story of his country within biblical story. And no story became more important than the big one of the Old Testament, the essential story of Exodus, you know, the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, the exile of the people into Egyptian bondage, the further exile, you know, to Sinai, and they get the law, and the further exile into the Babylonian captivity, and so on and so on. And finally, some, at least, reach a promised land. Well, that huge set of metaphors and stories we call the Exodus became a template for Douglass and for lots of other Americans. He's hardly alone in this. And in it, he could place himself,
yeah,
his people, and his nation. It became his principal source of storytelling.
And the idea here in many ways is this idea of America as having lost its favor as a chosen people because, yes, they turned away from God and their essential creed, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, well, and that turning away, of course, was most poignantly through slavery. That's
right.
The great subject of his,
right,
now famous 4th of July speech. It's this deep, deep hypocrisy of the American nation that has these beautiful creeds, has these wonderful first principles in the Declaration of Independence, but now 70-some years in just horribly violates them. And that 4th of July speech of 1852 is, I like to call it, the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism, for that matter, of American letters generally in the 19th century. And anyone who reads that speech carefully is going to note there are many biblical references, some of them direct, some of them are paraphrases, their uses of Isaiah, their uses of Jeremiah, their uses of the Psalms, particularly the 137th Psalm. He had a way of weaving biblical metaphor and story into his own prose and into his own uses, which is the sermonic tradition, of course, of great, you know, preacher storytellers. But it's also why, in the end, it took me a while to get the confidence to do this, but in the end, I do use the word prophet,
yeah,
in the title of this book, because Douglass did achieve, I believe, that category, that height of being a voice that was prophetic.
It's so interesting. He's traumatized, he's moved, he's influenced by the violence that he sees, but then he also has this kind of biblical perspective that the, mm-hmm, country has to be broken down before it can be rebuilt, and so he believes in, as you've put it, certain kinds of revolutionary violence as well. That's interesting.
Well, it is. He comes of age as a public abolitionist under, again, William Lloyd Garrison and the Massachusetts abolitionist who were his mentors. Indeed, Garrison was truly almost like a father figure mentor to him. Garrison was a pacifist, strictly so, and Douglass tried to toe that line for his first several years on the itinerant circuit as an abolitionist speaker. But in the end, he was not able to, and he could be enormously compassionate toward anyone undergoing oppression, and in many ways, one, you know, if you read the autobiographies, you'll see that he was compassionate toward slaveholders to the degree that he showed how slavery ruined them,
yeah,
poisoned them.
They were victims of a system.
Victims of a system,
yeah,
they didn't necessarily create, but they certainly operated.
Yeah.
On the other hand, by the 1850s, especially in the wake of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, fugitive slave rescues, the political ferment that grew from that into the early 1850s, he did become an advocate of certain kinds of uses, possible uses of violence against slavery. And you have to account for these paradoxes, these contradictions in Douglass. Like any major thinker and actor in history, you can't put him in a box.
Yeah.
He does advocate the possible uses of revolutionary violence, which means violence in the service of a particular political cause, can be justified. Now, that's not easy, as we all know. The morality of that is a very fuzzy line, and John Brown proves that. But it is why he does become close to John Brown. He becomes deeply influenced by John Brown, although in the end, he had the great good sense not to join John Brown at Harper's Ferry because he saw that particular strategy as a suicide mission, which is indeed what it was. And Douglass, though he came close, pulled out, pulled back, and thankfully did not go to Harper's Ferry. Otherwise, he likely would have been hanged along with Brown, and we wouldn't be sitting here talking about him.
Explain a little bit, David Blight, if you don't mind. He was an advocate of this natural rights tradition.
Yes.
This was something that he thought. Talk a little bit about this. This really informs the way he's thinking about all of this.
It may be the deepest root, that and the Bible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Enlightenment influence of the natural rights tradition and then the deep and ancient biblical influence, especially of the Old Testament, that really drives Douglass's thought. The natural rights tradition means essentially that, you know, we are all born under nature or under God with certain, as Jefferson said, inalienable rights. We have a right to life and liberty and property and pursuit of movement and, you know, ambition and happiness and so forth, that those rights are like natural ore. They're like, you know, the fossil fuels from the earth, or they're like iron ore from the earth. They are there for all of us. They're like the air we breathe. We have them because we are human. And that's a crucial set of ideas to abolitionists, crucial set of ideas to a black abolitionist, if you think about it, because they're declaring that whatever the natural rights tradition declares that whatever the law says, the law says these people are property, and it did. The law, the Constitution of the United States was deeply complicitous with slavery. The Fugitive Slave Act, the original one in the Constitution and the later one in 1850, said you are bound to return fugitive slaves because they are property under law. The natural rights tradition is saying whatever the law says, under God and under nature, we have these rights and no one can take them away and we are equal before God or nature. But of course, what history was moving toward and what the war on emancipation made possible was that next level, which meant equality before law, which got into the Constitution, of course, in the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Although abolitionists like Douglass have been arguing for that for decades. But natural rights tradition was at the deep root of Douglass's thought. And today, he's now studied by lots of political theorists, political scientists. There are no less than three books, at least now, there may be a fourth, on Douglass as a political philosopher. And most of them root his thought in this natural rights tradition that he gained from reading about the Enlightenment and he gained from American and British abolitionism. And what you get is a Douglass from that analysis that is a kind of a classic 19th century liberal in the sense that he came to believe that if you could establish these rights, then all solutions can be political, especially if people have the right to vote. If the natural rights tradition can be converted into political liberty, then people have the ability to protect themselves politically and therefore reach or attain some degree of equality. He put tremendous faith in politics and in the right to vote that he garnered from that natural rights tradition. And in the end, sometimes it may not have served him the best because, you know, he didn't have as much to say about the necessity of economic equality.
Well, it's interesting to hear modern-day conservatives I think on some level misappropriating his message. I mean, hearing them say Douglas was for limited government, which is kind of ridiculous, or saying that his message is about self-reliance, I think they misinterpreted in many ways too.
Well, I can't agree more, Doug, and I've said this in print. I did a piece in the New York Times op-ed page, I don't know, last February, I think, about this new book called Self-Made Man, which was produced by the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank that argued that Douglass's great legacy was in his famous speech and his writings about the self-made man, and they particularly hearken back to many speeches Douglass gave about black self-reliance and black individualism, and therefore they convert that into the idea that that's the core of Douglass's thought, and therefore he's anticipating modern conservatism and limited government. You know, you're on your own, make it on your own, recreate yourself, and so on, so on. To do that, well, first of all, it's true that he was an advocate of black self-reliance. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But all black leaders in the 19th century were. How could they not be?
Yeah.
How can you not, you know, preach self-reliance in a society that enslaves you, then wants to segregate you, then wants to lynch you? I mean, of course you have to be self-reliant. If they don't let you into schools, you're going to make your own. But to do that and say that's the core of Douglass's legacy is to ignore perhaps 90% of his life. It's to ignore his radical abolitionism, and it is to ignore particularly his fierce belief in activist interventionist use of government. You know, he believed in federal power to destroy slavery, to destroy the Confederacy, to recreate the U.S. Constitution and try to enforce it in Reconstruction. There's no reason we can't get our heads around the idea that on the one hand he can preach black self-reliance, especially to black audiences, but still believe in this activist vision of the use of government.
Yeah.
Why are the two so in conflict? It's because the modern conservative movement is always looking for somewhere in the past, especially to find a black hero that can make their argument for them about, you know, anti-government individualism. Sorry, it bothers me because it's such a misappropriation of Douglass.
Yeah.
But yet we all do it. I mean, Douglass is one of those figures now, a little bit like Lincoln.
Right.
Everybody wants to get Douglass on their side.
There's this speech that he gives, and I want to talk about in January of 1894. And let's talk about what's happening, because there's this wave of – you mentioned the statistics of lynchings. I think it was that year, 1892 or something like that. But there's an incredible amount of violence going on. The fate of the Republic was at stake in the crisis of violence, I think is how you put it in the book. And he gives this speech at the Metropolitan AME Church in Washington.
Right.
Would you talk about this? Because it seemed like an epic sort of moment for Douglass.
Well, it was, because it's right at the end of his life. He crafted that speech first in 93, and it was generally called Lessons of the Hour, although sometimes it was called, you know, Why the Negro is Lynched. He came finally to this issue because he had to. 1892 is a peak year. And just sheer numbers of lynchings across the South and some in the North. But what he does with that speech, and I really try to emphasize this, is an analysis of lynching. He doesn't just declare outrage.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of that. But he doesn't just, you know, scream in outrage against such horror. He analyzes it. Mm-hmm. And he does a kind of a three-part take. He says there have always been excuses for why this or that or this or that is done with black people. In slavery, he said, the excuse was the theory of black inferiority. Blacks weren't capable of this or capable of that. They needed control, they needed Christianizing, and they were born for labor, etc. Then, you know, the war is over and they weren't ready for emancipation, so they had to be controlled, and pretty soon you get Jim Crow and you get segregation, you get separation of the races because they're not ready. They're not capable, they're dangerous, and so forth. So that he calls the second excuse. And then thirdly, he says, well, now we're in a new era where the accusation is always sexual assault by black men of white women. But he says that, too, has become an excuse. You don't like the rise. I mean, he's saying this to white people. You don't like the rise of black people in the economy. You might not like the fact that we've got more schools now, or we're moving into this profession, or we're trying to. And he says, you know, black advancement is now the danger. So the new excuse becomes all this alleged sexual abuse by the, you know, so-called beast-like black male. And therefore, lynching becomes this kind of necessary action, necessary extra legal social action to cut out this, you know, alleged disease of black sexual assault. But it is an analysis of how this has come about historically. I think that's crucial because it shows us Douglass was always an analytical mind. He didn't just scream at the world.
Yeah.
I mean, he did some of that too, but
sure.
He didn't just declare his outrage. He gave those who listened lessons of the hour, a lesson in history, a lesson in social analysis, a lesson in the social psyche of the country that was tearing itself apart and could find a better path. Even that speech, he managed to find some way of ending on hope, which wasn't easy. And he ended on hope by, again, drawing back to the creeds, the original creeds. He still said he had faith that the country would live up to its creeds. But the key thing to think of there, that this is now an old man. He's in his mid-70s mm-hmm. when he wrote that speech. And that one you read there in 94, he's 76 years old, delivering this kind of analysis. And what we also have at that moment is this situation, going back to your question about the old radical who becomes the political insider. Well, this is the old radical who has now lived this huge trajectory of his life. He has now lived long enough to see that great triumph that happened in his 40s all but being betrayed and erased.
Yeah.
And he's got to have something to say about it.
Yeah.
He's got to explain it. And he goes to his desk and he does it again just the year before he died.
Yeah. I wanted to say something about the photographs that
sure.
that you write about, but are also included in the book, which are terrific. That cover photograph is extraordinary.
It's amazing. That's a beautiful young Douglass.
It really is. And he had been photographed, you say, more than any other American in the 19th century. It's really striking. And you mentioned in 1894 that he sits for some endearing photographs. I really like one that you include where he's smiling.
Which wasn't easy to capture because they had to sit quite a while, particularly for daguerreotypes.
Yeah.
And even the later versions. Yeah, he also had false teeth by then. You can, to some degree, see that as well. But he is smiling toward the end. I love some of the older photographs of Douglass, the older white-haired patriarch, mm-hmm. the man who actually looks like a prophet, whatever that means. But, yeah, he probably was the most photographed American of the 19th century. There's this recent terrific book by three friends of mine, John Stauffer, Celeste Bernier, and Zoe Trod. The book is called Picturing Frederick Douglass, and they have collected in one book all of the extant photos of Douglass with lots of explanations of when they were taken and by whom and why. Mm. There have even been a couple more discovered since that book came out. But I think he was the most photographed American for a variety of reasons, not least of which was he traveled so much.
Yeah.
He traveled all the time, lecturing all over the country. And everywhere he went, local photographers wanted him to come sit for a photo. Plus, he cultivated these photographers. He wanted to have his photo taken. He wanted to demonstrate, as you can see in those photos, the upright, good-looking, well-dressed, obviously educated mm-hmm. black man.
Yeah.
Who was there to make a statement before your eyes. Look at me. Look at what we've become. Look at the possibilities of our lives. We're not slaves anymore. I'm not. And come listen to me, you know. And when he managed some of these photographers, you know, but do this profile, do that profile, and so on. He knew he was creating a record of his own image by doing this. He also, you know, again, I like to add that he was constantly asked to do this.
Right.
This became part of his perilous problem with fame everywhere he went.
Well, it gets to the last months of his life, and you mentioned that he was remarkably active and engaged in those last months, but also being called upon to give speeches and to give to lend money. And the day that he dies, February 20th, he is scheduled to give a lecture that night. And you mentioned this note that he gets from a destitute African-American man asking for money, I think. And you meant
from right down the hill, right in the neighborhood.
Exactly. And he mentions this passage, brings us back to the Bible, to Isaiah, that Douglas had apparently included in some speech. And in some way, you say it turns out to be an epitaph for him.
It is, in a way. It's amazing that, when Douglas has used the Old Testament prophets, the Hebrew prophets, so many times in speeches, and that there's this man essentially homeless and needs money. And by the way, Douglas got lots of begging letters in those last few years of his life, which I show in the book. It's just amazing how many people thought he was loaded with money.
Yeah.
But this man writes to him, quotes from Isaiah, and asks the man up on the hill in the big house to help him out. Help him survive. Don't know if Douglas read it. Don't know if he did anything about it. Probably not, because as I recall, it was written literally the day before he died.
Yeah.
But it does make an incredibly poignant ending there of getting one of these begging letters that actually quotes Isaiah back to him.
Yeah.
Asking for help, And, of course, the older Douglas, that aging man, I found to be utterly enthralling and fascinating. If Americans tend to know much about Douglas, it's usually the younger heroic Douglas, the man who escaped from slavery and wrote about it and became a great orator. But the aging man is so fascinating, so much, so modern. He's got this huge extended family, 4 surviving adult children, 21 grandchildren, even some fictive kinfolk he adopts, and they adopt him.
Right.
And they all end up, by and large, in one way or another, financially dependent upon him. So he woke up every day from the 1870s on, the patriarch of this huge extended family that was almost always in conflict with each other. That's a very human story, and it's the story behind those autobiographies that you have to get to by other means, and I surely made a good attempt at it, at least.
Well, there's that problem of the 21st century you mentioned in the book, and what we make of Frederick Douglass now, and just in hearing you speak over the last hour or so, I mean, incredibly relevant for what's going on today. What do you think is the legacy that, as we think about him now, this idea of being a radical at some point, trying to find compromise at some point, trying to redeem a country that he felt was absolutely worth redemption, all of those things.
He never lost faith in the essential creeds of America. If you believe America is a set of ideas at its core, he never lost belief in those creeds, although he came close a few times with good reason. He also then delivered. I think this is a huge part of his legacy. He delivered a critique of America, a ferocious critique, a critique like the Hebrew prophets who were there chastising their people, declaring their ruin before they could ever be made whole again or be made good again. I also think his story is essential to us to just understand his endurance not only of slavery, but then of racism. He got Jim Crowed more times than he could count.
Yeah.
He had to face this kind of hopelessness. To be an African-American in the United States in 1857, the day after the Dred Scott case, was to be told, you have no future here. You can never be citizens. You've been defined out of the country. And yet you still had to, if you still wanted to stay, which he did, you had to fight back against that. You had to have an analysis to fight back against that. You had to have a worldview that made you ready to fight back against that. And then, again, he lives on in the words, millions of words, brilliant words. He had that capacity of the prophet to find the words to explain a situation, a pivot in history, a disaster in history, a victory in history, a huge social problem. He had that capacity to find the words to explain that most of the rest of us cannot find. That's the function, the role of a prophet. That's the ability of a prophet. And often that prophet makes us hurt. They don't make us feel good. They don't make us, you know, want to live some triumph. They warn us constantly. His voice is always there as the kind of Jeremiah warning about the underside of American hypocrisy, about every time we think we've won a victory, look out, because the forces of reaction and counter-revolution are about to come around and probably whack us between the eyes. And have we not just experienced that in the past couple of years? The Obama phenomenon allowed people to think that the United States had really turned a remarkable corner in our history. We elected a black president, for God's sake. How could that be? Well, it caused a counter-revolution. All revolutions cause counter-revolutions. And now we're living in the counter-revolution, wherever it's going. Douglas is there and analyzing that and showing us that with the greatest revolution and counter-revolution that we've ever experienced, which was slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and its aftermath. He lived that entire experience, and he had so much to say about it that often feels like it came out of today's headlines.
David Blight is a professor of American history at Yale University. His new biography is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. He joined us from the studios on the Yale campus in New Haven, Connecticut. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.